Okay. All right. All suffering comes from wanting your own happiness. Complete awakening arises from the intention to help others. So exchange completely your happiness for the suffering of others. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Even if someone driven by desperate want steals or makes someone else steal everything you own, dedicate to him your body, your wealth, and all the good you've ever done or will do. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Even if you have done nothing wrong at all, and someone still tries to take your head off, spurred by compassion, take all his or her evil into you. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Pretty straightforward.
No problem.
Glad to hear it. Well, as we've done before, any technical points, translations, things like that you're curious about? Joe.
In 12, the phrase driven by desperate want. In other places, it was need, which was close. But what happened to me is I wondered if that was a qualification of someone, or whether it was an explanation. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. The Tibetan for driven by desperate want is du chen wangi. Du is the word for desire, to want. Not in the sense of greed, but or need, just to want. Okay? And chen is the word for great. So, great desire. And then the wang is the word for power, influence. Authority. So I chose to translate that phrase, and probably in other translations it might be said by the power of great desire. Is there anything like that in any of the other translations? Yeah. Pardon? Sway of compulsive desire. Okay. So whether you call it compulsive or desperate, great in this sense means, yeah, they really want something. So,
but is it a qualification? Is it, what if it's not great desire? What if it is? What if it's semi-great desire?
Oh, I see. So that dojo wangi. It's not really a qualification here. It's saying, I think the idea in the Tibetan is that anybody who steals is pretty desperate.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not a qualification in that sense. Other questions? Yes?
The first line of 11, all suffering comes from wanting your own happiness. I was struck by that because of the metta practice, which begins with, may I be happy.
Yeah,
be healthy, you know.
Yeah.
And then I'm looking at this going, okay, this is a contradiction. Or is it in the word wanting?
Well, as you say, in the metta practice, as it's taught in the Theravadin, you wish happiness for yourself, and then from there you start wishing happiness for other beings, and so forth. And here it's saying all suffering comes from wanting your own happiness. So, little conflict, apparently. It's really a difference in method. And I think it's important when you read, let me back up a step. The word Dharma, as in the Buddha Dharma, basically means how do you do it? Instruction. Now, let's take a very different discipline for a moment. Let's say martial arts. Okay, there are all kinds of schools of martial arts. And what is taught in one school may be the absolute opposite of what is taught in another school. But it works in that school because it's embedded in a system where there's a whole bunch of other things. Mm-hmm. And but if you just took it out of that and worked on it by took it by itself, it might seem to contradict something in another school. So, whenever you come across an instruction, and it's really best to regard all Buddhist teaching as instruction in some way or other. It may be an explicit instruction, or it may be implicit in that it's setting a framework in order to give you instruction. But we even have contradictory frameworks in Buddhism because they're leading up to instructions which work in substantially different ways. So what happens is that people attach to, well, it says this here and you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And that actually is not terribly useful. Mm-hmm. Because I mean I've given completely opposite instructions to people at various points, you know, and I'm just one teacher, let alone a broad tradition which has adapted to different cultures and over very long stretches of time. So, in the metta practice, the intention there is, you know, everybody you want to be happy, and by wishing yourself happiness, you develop a softness of attitude, a softness in mind. And so it sort of goes, well, yeah, it's kind of nice to be happy, you know. And I'm feeling good about that. Yeah, it'd be kind of nice if my friends were happy. Well, maybe the people, you know, I don't dislike, but I don't really like, maybe they could be happy too. Oh, now there's just those people I don't like. Well, I don't have any really good reason for them not to be happy. I'm just causing myself unhappiness if I don't wish them to be happy. And so it expands and expands. And that's what I mean about the system there. In the mind training system, and it's fair to say, historically, this is probably a later development, sometime after the Theravadin being isolated in Sri Lanka and so forth. This is probably a later development. The idea was, I need to stop putting myself first in the world. Because let's face it, when I put myself first, everybody else suffers. And if everybody puts themselves first, we're all going to suffer. Now, there's a workshop that I give, but one of the lines from it is, know, when there's a problem in the world, we always put the problem out there. We make up a story, and we're the hero of the story. And we think, if people would just do things differently, then everything would be fine. We're always looking at everybody else to change. Well, if you're always looking at everybody else to change, what change takes place? Well, everybody's looking at everybody else to change, so nothing happens. So this way is, okay, I don't care what everybody else is doing. I'm going to stop contributing to suffering by not putting myself first. So it's a very different method. And that's why, even though the instructions look totally contradictory, one really has to look at them in the context of the philosophy and the approach and the method that each are defining.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ken, completed that. How is it different to exchange happiness, your own happiness, for the suffering of others? How is that different than giving up yourself as the primary concern and being concerned with the sufferings and welfare of others? One sounds like vicarious suffering, like I'm going to take on the suffering of the world and not be concerned with my own life at all. And the other sounds like not being preoccupied with your own desires and being sensitive to all others around you. It seems like a difference. I most of the translations that I've been reading are exchange your own happiness for the sufferings of others. Another one that I read, which says, thus, in exchange for our selfish desires and shameful neglect of our suffering kin, replace thoughts of self with concern for all others.
Is that Alex Berzin's?
Huh?
Yeah, I thought so. He adds a few little ideas in there to make it into nice English.
Well, it raised it. My question is In taking in sending, as I understand it, you are taking on, you're experiencing the suffering around you. Right?
George, okay. Put this in two sentences.
Okay. How are the two different translations different, or are they the same things?
That's not your question. What bugs you here?
The concept of actually suffering yourself.
Ah, thank you. Much better. I thought you were talking around stuff there. You don't like that idea.
Well,
keep it nice and short here.
Yeah.
Okay, good. That's all we need. Now.
I mean, it's different than being concerned.
No. Okay, so what I'm gathering from you is I can get this idea of not wanting others to suffer and not even putting myself first. But this idea of really taking on their suffering and giving away my own happiness, I don't like this. Something like that?
Not quite that far. More like, I can see not being concerned with my own pleasure.
Right.
I can see not being concerned that my own happiness is the objective of my life.
Okay.
I can see that participating in the sufferings of others is part of being an awake person. But that doesn't mean that I have to suffer too.
I don't think we're too far apart here. Okay. The problem is not in whether you suffer or not. The problem is whether you try to avoid suffering or not.
Yeah.
And that's very scary. Taking on the suffering of others. That's very scary. Because it goes against the way that we feel we have to protect ourselves. But that sense of self-protection is completely associated with a sense of self. So as long as you're holding on to any sense of self-protection, you're never going to let go of a sense of self.
So if you no longer avoid suffering, you're free.
Yes. I mean, don't forget, Buddhism says this is the end of suffering. There is an end to suffering. Here's how you get there. But one has to look at what exactly does that end of suffering consist of? Now, it's helpful to remember there's a distinction between pain and suffering. Pain is a sensation. It arises. You know, somebody sticks a needle in your arm or drops a brick on your toe, or you're in a relationship and she decides to leave, or you experience pain. Somebody betrays you. You experience pain. Physical pain, emotional pain. Suffering is the reaction to experience. You with me? Yeah.
And in your book, didn't you say that it's the reaction to not experience? Because in the taking and sending portion, I think you said something along that line.
Well, you'll have to find that reference.
I got it right here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's the reaction to experience. Now, you're never going to be able to release any of those reactions into their own nature as long as you keep pushing them away. You follow?
Yeah, they're always going to be an object that you're contending with.
Exactly. So, to disengage from that whole reactive process, you have to be willing to experience the pain that arises as part of life.
Would you actually go seek it out?
I don't see why one needs to seek it out. There are various people who would I found it useful to keep something which nudges them along. Atisha and his Bengali tea boy is the famous example for that. But I personally, I don't find it's necessary to seek it out. There's plenty around there already. And as your awareness becomes clearer, you're able to perceive it more clearly. Now, just in what you're saying, I don't want to suffer. That's not okay with me. Well, you have some pain right there. There's a struggle right there. And lately, I've been experimenting in some context with translating suffering as struggle. So, all struggles come from one's desire to be happy. Okay? Full awakening comes from desiring to help others, from the intention to help others, which basically means, well, can mean, to help others be free from their own struggles. Okay? And that changes it a bit, doesn't it? Now, what is involved when you try to help someone be free from their own struggles?
You live suffering from your world and their world simultaneously.
Yeah, but what happens in the process? I know something about this because I do this, you know, almost full time.
You're involved.
You have to be present with them.
Yeah.
Okay? Is that always a happy place to be?
No. But it's not necessarily an unhappy place either.
Yes, but if you desire happiness, how often are you going to go there?
Oh, I see.
Okay.
But that doesn't... Yeah, I was having almost this image of Christ bearing his cross in the world.
No, I don't think you need to be Christ. You can work up to that. But... But for the time being, one of the things you're working on is your sense of how you connect with the world. Well, start observing. What do you do when another person is behaving in a way which causes you disturbance? That's what I want you to start working on explicitly. What goes on in you when you're interacting with another person who's causing you disturbance? Okay. John?
Well, I was on that level, I'm irritated, and if you're practicing properly, I assume you're saying thank you very much for allowing me to have some patience. Then, on the other level of searching for happiness, there's probably very few moments in the day when I'm not trying to make myself either warmer or more comfortable or looking forward to what I'm going to get to eat. It's consistent search for self.
Yeah, okay.
Can you define happiness?
What's behind that?
Well, in this level of discussion, conduct versus mental practice, it occurs to me that there might be a slight differential between the definition of happiness and those two kinds.
What are you suggesting? Okay, I see what you're driving at. I don't know the Theravadin framework well enough to comment on that directly. But, picking up from what you're saying here, the exploration of what is happiness can be quite useful. and relatively quickly leads you into a pretty straightforward Mahayana framework. The essential peace being, can you be happy, George, if someone close to you is suffering? So you don't have any choice but to join where they are. And so if you're constantly desiring your own happiness, you're never going to join with them. Follow? On the other hand, it is by understanding what it means to be happy that you do find a way to join with them. Do you see what I mean by that?
In terms of sharing happiness with them?
No, in terms of being willing to help them find a way to release their struggles, which involves not protecting you yourself from what they're experiencing. Yes.
I was thinking of, because it's all suffering comes from looking for your own happiness, it's to the exclusion of others.
And that's right.
And the other, and the metta, you're just wishing happiness. So it's an offer in this way as opposed to a selfish.
That's right.
And that was what I was going toward in the
Okay. Jessica.
Yeah. Almost say, or go so far as to say, all suffering comes from wanting, period?
Oh, yes, very much.
And drop the happiness or wanting things to be other than they are, or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, they all come down to the same thing. Certain formulations are more useful to some people than others. This is written in relatively formal language, or at least some of the phrases are. Okay. There's another, in keeping with some perspectives that we talked about last time, there's another whole way of relating to this. Okay? What is this I that wants to be happy? And I don't actually mean this in an insight sense, in a non-self sense. I'm not at that level yet. What is the I that wants to be happy? Let me put it this way. Is it all of you? Usually it isn't. It's only a very particular part of you in a given moment. And by trying to make that part of you happy, a whole bunch of other parts of you get neglected. And now you start to struggle. This makes sense?
Okay.
Yes.
But in that formulation, isn't the part that wants to be happy by definition always louder than the other parts, whichever one it is at that moment?
Yes. What's your point there? Whenever one voice dominates, you make a point of hearing all the other voices. That can be a practice. Well, I want this. And immediately we collapse down to that, as you say, the loudest voice. And we neglect everything else. So as soon as you find yourself doing that, okay, well, yeah, there's that, but what else is there here? Well, there's part of me saying, another part of me saying, no, I don't really want that. Or another part saying, we don't care, can we move on? And, I mean, there's all kinds of things going on. And that way you move back to relating to the whole of your experience rather than just a part of it. Because in one sense, the whole discussion of bodhicitta and taking and sending can be regarded as a kind of mythic approach to encouraging us to work with every aspect of our experience. When we say all sentient beings, well, that's like the whole universe. But from the Mahayana point of view, the whole universe is nothing but our own mind. So by working for the welfare of all beings, we are embracing the totality of our experience. And by rejecting a single sentient being, we are rejecting part of our own psyche, if you wish. Do you follow? So you can look at it as a mythic way of doing that. It's never translated into that in literal terms, but that's the effect of working that way. Steve?
So I think about what Jessica said. It's not, there's nothing here saying that we won't ever feel happy. It's that it's the wanting of it. It's the desiring it.
Yeah.
If your experience comes up, some of that will be a sensation of happiness. But we're not going after it. Is that?
Well, yes, and that's right. And you can get the idea that, and here's where I think our puritanical upbringing or conditioning comes in. Where there is laughter, the devil is not far behind. That's true. As one of Calvin's sayings. And so you're dour and serious. And Buddhism doesn't take that approach. You experience whatever's arising. If you're feeling good, nothing wrong with that. If you're feeling bad, nothing wrong with that. But that's not how we approach it most of the time. If I'm feeling good, I usually say, oh, this is how I should feel all the time. Am I going to try to hold on to this? Because this is what I want. Right? And when you're feeling bad, you go, something's wrong. I've got to go to a doctor or get a lawyer or do something to fix it. And so we're immediately struggling with experience, struggling to hold on or struggling to avoid. How different is it when, oh, I'm feeling good. Fine. I'm feeling bad. Okay. I can live with this. And what taking and sending is, and this business of exchange, is a way of undermining our attachment to pleasure and our aversion to unpleasantness. It's a way of undermining those basic dynamics in us. Okay? Other questions?
Yes, of course. We were talking about want and desire a second ago. Can we make a distinction in the language we're using now between want and desire and clinging to the result of that want and desire? I mean, can we okay for ourselves the fact of want and desire? can we not isolate and shun that part of our experience if we don't cling to the results?
What are you trying to protect here, Joe?
Want desire.
You want desire?
Well, I want desire. I want to desire bodhicitta. I want to desire to be a bodhisattva. I want to desire, more mundane things, too. I want to desire good food. I want to desire sensual gratification.
Well, The language gets very slippery here, both just the way we use language, rather. It's not really dependent on the language, Tibetan or English. But one can tie oneself up in philosophical knots very easily, right?